On this week's 51%, a professor of entertainment studies hopes to draw more women into video gaming.
Do you play like a feminist by trying out new things and getting outside of your comfort zone?
Hear about a film project to highlight suffragists on Election Day and learn why the name of the Democratic vice presidential candidate sparks conversation. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Oh dear, what can the matter be, dear? Dear, what can the matter be? Oh dear, what can the matter be? Women are wanting to vote. Women are traveling about here and there. Women are working like men everywhere. Women are crowding, then claiming 'tis fair. Why are they wanting to vote?
An effort is underway for local filmmakers to capture voters in New York visiting suffragist gravesites in their communities on Election Day. The project is from Women and the Vote, New York State. I spoke with Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Linda Maroney about the project. On August 26th, Women and the Vote New York State launched a mobile-friendly interactive website and map celebrating historic New York suffragists. That date marked the 100th anniversary of the adoption of the 19th Amendment into law, giving women the right to vote. Maroney, co-owner of Low to the Ground Productions, conceived the idea and talks about how this year's project got started.
We made a short film that was shot at Susan B. Anthony's gravesite on Election Day and the day after, called Election Day 2016. And on that day, spontaneously, 10,000 people came out to pay tribute to Susan B. Anthony. And they brought their I Voted stickers, which have become an incredible source of pride, as people are aware. And they put their stickers on her headstone, and it was a celebration, and it was this really, really inspiring day that we wanted to capture as filmmakers. But it became pretty clear that Susan B. Anthony, you know, very important to the story of women's suffrage, but she didn't do it alone. And it would be wonderful if we could, you know, help push this situation so that other communities could celebrate suffragists within, you know, within their own hometowns. So that on Election Day, if they're in Buffalo or Albany or Montauk or, Rhinebeck, people could go out and pay tribute to suffragists within their own communities. And that's kind of where this project all stemmed from originally.
She has a few hopes for the project.
Well, my hope would be that this encourages people to go out and that it becomes, you know, a day of celebration in a lot of ways, that we can go out and vote. Hopefully there is no voter suppression and all the other shenanigans that, you know, that it clearly is going on right now, too. But hopefully we can go out and I mean, I really feel like Election Day should be a national holiday, and maybe this is sort of pushing a little bit towards that, but also to really sort of engage in conversations with people within your own communities. I mean, it's sort of grassroots in a lot of ways, this project, even though it's a statewide project. But it's encouraging to find out what the history is in your own community and how that may connect to where you are today and what choices we're making, and be able to have a space to be able to create this dialogue. And again, luckily, it's outdoors. Hopefully the weather will be good, but we never know. And then to create a film that captures this historic moment, you know, 100 years later after the 19th Amendment has been passed and where we are now. I think there's something to be said about capturing this moment in time. You know, we have, as filmmakers, we have ideas what the film may be like. You know, it's really hard to say exactly what we're going to get. But the idea for the film is to capture that and also weave it with threads of archival stills and footage and audio from the past of all these people that have done the work to get us where we are today.
And will you be traveling the state to do that?
No, we are going to work with filmmakers. We want filmmakers to shoot in their own communities, in the cemeteries, in their own communities on that day. Again, it has that sort of it mirrors then the whole suffrage movement, which was done by so many people, right? It wasn't all the same person or type of person. So we want to work with different types of filmmakers to capture that. And so as the website is going live now, we want to reach out to filmmakers all over the state and capture as many of these locations as we possibly can. For me, what has been really fascinating to see is how the suffrage movement was interconnected with so many other movements going on at the same time. So it's threaded with abolition. It's threaded with labor practices and changing labor, you know, the labor movement. It's threaded with the temperance movement and how that affected women and how they didn't own anything. And the husbands had, you know, the purse strings, they, you know, and would decide how all of the family money was spent. So, you know, it's tied together in so many different ways that also just makes it so clear how things are so much more connected and not isolated issues. And that's sort of where we are today now, too, to see how things are so connected. And that's the way it's always been. And we should always be mindful of that.
Maroney is also encouraging mindfulness about stickers on headstones.
You know, we're encouraging people to go out to cemeteries on Election Day, but to follow the cemetery's rules. Some of them do not want stickers on headstones because the adhesive deteriorates, you know, whatever stone is there. So we definitely want people to follow the rules of their cemeteries. But they could bring flowers or things that'll, you know, compost a lot easier. Some people brought notes or, you know, on paper and things like that.
Carol White Llewellyn is part of the project. She says more than 30 volunteers have contributed to the research behind the database that launched in August.
The database has the location of the cemetery, if not the grave. It has a bio about the person, and it also has often very often photos of the person or the gravesite. And so linked to this, map where people can go in on site to womeninthevoteNYS.com and check to see who is buried in their community and the location of the graves of those people or the cemeteries of those people and go out and visit. And there's the other aspect of it is that if they discover that there's someone in their family, in their community who's not listed there, they can go online and add those people, and we will include them in our database so that they will also be celebrated.
Again, filmmakers will be stationed at many of the cemeteries across the state on November 3rd to record interviews with visitors paying respects at suffragist grave sites. The interviews recorded will lay the groundwork for a new documentary, Election Day 2020 New York State, that will be directed and produced by Linda Maroney.
Joseph, tell us something new. We're tired of that old song. We'll sew the seams and cook the meals. To vote won't take us long. We will help clean house, the one too large for man to clean alone. The state and nation, don't you see, when we the vote have won. Yes, we will, and you'll help, for you'll need our help. Friend Joseph, yes, you will, when we're in. So you'd better help us win.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Marty Moscoane. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women that made possible a century of progress. Women like Emma Gonzalez. She was a high school senior in Parkland, Florida, when on Valentine's Day 2018, a mass shooter killed 17 people at her school, the worst high school shooting in American history. Gonzalez channeled her grief into activism and quickly became a prominent gun control advocate. With other survivors, she started the Political Action Committee Never Again MSD and organized the 2018 March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C., where she gave a powerful speech. The daughter of Cuban immigrants, Gonzalez was president of the high school's Gay Straight Alliance. Now a college student, Emma Gonzalez continues her activism on Twitter. Her handle, For Emma for Change, has 1.6 million followers. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
You play like a girl. It's meant to be an insult. Shira Chess is an associate professor of entertainment and media studies at the University of Georgia and the author of Ready Player Two, Women Gamers and Designed Identity. Her new book, Play Like a Feminist, urges us to play video games like feminists, and Chess describes that play as empowering and disruptive, exceeding the boundaries of gender while still advocating for gender equality. Chess spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about the role of video games in society and why she thinks they're important.
The reality is that play is an important part of life, that leisure is an important part of life, and we don't always recognize that value and that importance, and video games are a really great way to get there.
What are the current statistics with female players versus male players?
So they vary a lot. The statistics vary a lot. However, depending on where you look, I would say about half of all gamers are identifying as female. And the statistics are tricky because part of it comes down to what is considered a game. So what the interviewers consider a game. So I've seen the statistics vary anywhere from 47% to 52%. So I like to just say about half.
How do you play like a feminist?
You play like a feminist by trying out new things and getting outside of your comfort zone. We often get stuck in ruts as we get older. We play in the same ways that we've been playing for years and years, and it's hard to try new things. But video games in particular are a space to experiment with. It's an exciting new space that it's not even that new. I'm being hyperbolic here. Where a lot of innovation is happening right now. There are a lot of emerging independent game designers out there making really interesting things. And there are also bigger game companies making really interesting things. The only way for the industry to change is for more people to play, because there needs to be a cost benefit to justify those new players.
How many women are designing video games?
I believe at the last survey of the IGDA, about 22% of the video game industry identified as men. So that means that roughly if half of all gamers or game players are women and girls, and 22% of the people working in that industry, and that's even a tricky number because that includes non-designer positions, then that means that there are a lot of people designing for audiences that are not them. Within that, making a lot of assumptions about those audiences. But in terms of playing like a feminist, we also play like a feminist by thinking about playful ways of protest. We also play like a feminist by thinking about leisure equality beyond ourselves. Leisure is not zero sum, and thinking about the leisure of those around us and making sure that those around us are getting the leisure in their lives, the leisure that they need, is so necessary to making sure that equality is happening in the lives of those around us. We're often dismissive of that. And so all of these things together is how we play like a feminist.
You have this great line that I absolutely love. It's a new way to think about how feminists do their feministing. And you argue that feminism needs video games as much as video games need feminism. Can you go into that?
The video game industry has been caught in ruts for many years now, doing things in very similar ways. And there's begun to be innovation, but only insofar as there have been new audiences and new game designers over the last decade that have really started pushing at the boundaries of what a game gets to be and what a player gets to be. So the video game industry needs the innovation of having more feminists playing games, and feminists need to be playing games and not necessarily as dismissive of video games as a medium that is exciting and that can give them a lot of everyday small pleasures.
You offer solutions as well, like the women's gaming circles. Can you talk about that theory and practice?
So I started running a women's gaming circle about six months to a year after my previous book came out. I wrote a book called Ready Player Two. And one thing that I noticed, a thing that was happening pretty regularly when that book came out, was that women would come over to me in ways that they had never come over before. Previous to that book, people would come over to me and say, I'd say I study video games, and they'd say, oh, I hate video games, they're so violent. Or, you know, I don't let people play video games in my household, or various versions of that. But suddenly after I wrote my book, people would come over and say, you know, you've recommended this game, and I was blown away by it. I didn't know that video games could be that, or video games could look like that. I just don't understand. And I realized that at a certain point, there's a lot of conversations that are happening inside the industry itself about what video games are and what they're becoming and what they get to be, that a lot of non-gamers, a lot of other people are not privy to, don't know, they don't necessarily know enough about the games that are out there. And so I started asking the question, well, how do I get more women, more people who are game curious, not necessarily just women, but women certainly, how do I get them into the game? How do I help people figure out what games are out there, what is interesting, and find support networks for people that are not intimidating? And some of that is about teaching vocabulary, you know, helping people figure out the vocabulary that's already out there. So I lightly started running my own gaming circle locally. I brought in a bunch of people that I knew that were game curious, and I asked them to start playing games. And for about a year, we all played games together. We would meet up once a month. We would play a game. I would come to the meeting with some questions, and we would talk it through, kind of like a book club. And it was pretty fantastic. And I thought, well, why aren't we doing this more broadly? Why isn't this something that all over women can do, or people, game curious people can do? And along with my book, I've actually created a website, playlikeafeminist.com, where I have a bunch of game recommendations with questions that people can ask to facilitate discussion. I also give, or I provide links to tips and walkthroughs. And I overall try and give descriptions that so that people will know what they're getting into. And yeah. So I'm hoping that people will find these recommendations and either on their own or with friends, small groups of friends or book clubs that already exist, can find games that work for them, because it's about creating that vocabulary. If I said to someone who was not a regular game player, well, this game is a real-time strategy game, that's not something that necessarily they might know what that means, and they wouldn't know whether or not they liked it. But the more games you play, the more you can figure out your taste, just like any other medium, right? The more movies you watch, the more it helps define your taste. The more books you read, the more it helps define your taste.
Are there any games right now that are at the top of your list?
Absolutely. So I'm going to say a few different games here. For one, I would say one of the first games that I always like to recommend to beginning gamers is a game called Monument Valley. And there are two versions of it. There's Monument Valley and Monument Valley 2. And it's this sort of sublime visual puzzle that a lot of people who had previously thought they didn't like playing video games play that and find the pleasures of puzzle solving with stunning art. And those are the kinds of artful literary games that I really like to highlight. There are other games that I have talked about a bit. Stardew Valley is one that really has an emerging audience. And some of that audience has now moved to a game called Animal Crossing, which I'm sure some audience members have heard of. The new version of Animal Crossing is this brilliant situation where it has allowed people who are not able to physically connect at the moment to find some space, some virtual space to connect with one another. And I just hear story after story about people who are dealing with the alienation post-COVID or during COVID, and trying to figure out ways to connect with people from far away or even in their households that's different from what they've done before. And games like Animal Crossing, to some extent, Stardew Valley, although there's the co-op on Stardew Valley is not quite the same. Those are the kinds of games that can really help us figure out what we like to play, how to play with one another, how to move past this vision of video games as just sort of violent gun-filled explosions, right? There are other kinds of games out there that are artful and that are literary and that are interesting. And those are the games that I like to see highlighted and that I think can really help bring in more game curious people who would get so much out of these experiences. And so I have been seeing a lot more new people playing video games for sure in the last 6 months, which is pretty amazing. Sadly, because of COVID-19, the idea of gaming circles in person is now not something that we can really do, right?
Right.
However, it is certainly, there are many book clubs out there that are meeting on Zoom. And even if people don't want to start a gaming circle, aren't ready for that yet, there's still something to be said for going out there and trying to find curated lists of games that matter, games that are meaningful or potentially meaningful, and use that to figure out what you like and how to get into the game.
Shira Chess is Associate Professor of Entertainment and Media Studies at the University of Georgia. She was speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her new book, Play Like a Feminist. It's published by MIT Press. What's in a name? KALW Sandeep Roy brings us his take on mispronunciations, especially when it comes to the Democratic vice presidential candidate.
Can I just call you Sandy? Asked my first American roommate. No, I replied tersely. Both Sandeep and Sandy had two syllables, and I reasoned if he could pronounce the latter, he could jolly well deal with the former. Joe Biden's pick of Kamala Harris as his running mate reminded me of that brief encounter. Her name and how it should be pronounced has become as much a topic of debate as her political track record.
Will you pronounce your name for me, please?
It's Kamala.
Kamala.
Just think of like a comma and add a la.
Okay.
The furor over a Kamala seems to be much ado over very few syllables, especially when viewed from India, where there have been prime ministers with names like Pamulaparthi Venkata Narasimha Rao and Jawaharlal Nehru. But in America, the name is often the first part of oneself that melts away in the melting pot. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. When I moved to Silicon Valley in the 90s, I was amused to find scores of ads from Indian American realtors and dentists where Bhavesh had become Bob and Sunita had become Sue. I could empathize. It was just easier that way, less alien sounding, better for business. At that time, studies had not come out that showed people with African-American sounding names like Lakeisha or Jamal had lower chances of being called in for job interviews. One wonders if Namrata Randhawa would have had as much political success in South Carolina as a Nikki Haley. Immigrants and children of immigrants innately understood that American dread of the unfamiliar. Journalist Kamala Thyagarajan, who grew up in the U.S. in the 80s and 90s, remembers no one could pronounce her name right.
It was always Kamala instead of Kamala. I remember a particularly tense conversation with my dad when I asked him after being absolutely fed up why he just didn't name me Becky or Karen or something easy for people around me to pronounce.
And now she shakes her head in amazement.
As my namesake, a Black woman of mixed heritage, both Jamaican and Indian, is nominated to one of the most powerful positions in American politics. But all I can think is, oh my God, they said her name right.
But not everyone did. When Fox News host Tucker Carlson was corrected about his pronunciation of Harris's name, he flew into a tizzy.
So it begins. You're not allowed to criticize Kamala Harris or Kamala Harris or whatever,
Kamala Harris.
That blithe disregard for something as intrinsic as a person's name is telling. That Kamala Harris has a name that can be mispronounced is not the issue. Even in India, her name could be pronounced in different ways, none of them wrong per se.
Kamala.
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 What is wrong is the fact that to some people, it does not matter if they mangle her name. For decades, newer Americans have often willingly whitewashed their own names as part of the price of admission into the American dream. They learned to grin and bear it and post pictures of coffee cups with their names mangled in the felt-tipped scrawl of the Starbucks barista. That's why thousands of Indian American children are routinely called Neil or Sonia, names that don't jar American ears, while still retaining some shade of their Indian heritage. Of course, there are shades of difference, even when it comes to foreign-sounding names, a caste system of sorts. I mean, the U.S. has dealt with far more polysyllabic names bristling with consonants in public life before than Kamala Harris.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, a towering figure in American foreign policy.
Roll this around on your tongue. Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I sometimes wonder what my old roommate would have made of it all. He yielded to my intransigence and called me Sandeep or Sandip or some version of it. But I think my refusal to become Sandy cast a pall over our relationship. We didn't even last a year. Since then, America has changed. Barack Obama ran for office as Barack, not Barry, and Kamala Harris will remain Kamala and refuse to give her interlocutors any other option. It is their way of saying that they too sing America. And when I see news anchors training to not mispronounce Kamala while they marvel at her life's trajectory from roots in Jamaica and Chennai to the Democratic ticket as the apotheosis of the American dream, I do not see it as America finally embracing something that sounds foreign as much as its bemused embrace of itself.
You say either, I say either, you say neither. And I say neither, either, either, and either, neither. Let's call the whole thing off.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
I like potato, you like tomato. I like tomato, potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we ever part, then that might break my heart. So if you like pajamas, I like pajamas. I'll wear pajamas, give up pajamas. For we know we need each other so.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1630.